Hey guys, we're back. Another episode of Smart Brand Marketing. Today I have someone special with me. I've followed this guy for a while, read some of his books, and Perry Marshall, how are you?
Great to be here. Awesome. It's 8 o'clock in the morning there and 7 o'clock in the evening here. So we're gonna have an international worldwide celebration today. So
definitely are.
It's great to be here.
It was funny too when I seen you pop up in the calendar, like I had to double check with the assistant. I was like, you sure you got the name right?
Well, I'm glad to be here, and I enjoyed reading your opinionated take on the world and your website, and smuggling stuff into countries, and being the baby that's supposed to cry if the security guards are go wrong. Well, all right, that's a spicy way to enter the world, right?
It's definitely a little different, right? But yeah, Perry, when I look through your offerings, a lot of them are online courses, and that's one of the main focuses of my business and this podcast. So hopefully we can talk about that and just figure out how you got the pricing right, what's the 80-20 of the marketing for your courses. If we can just go into that topic and just chat about it, I think that'd be awesome.
Well, so, it's an interesting last 20 years or so, because if you go to the late 90s and early 2000s, information marketing was all the rage, and you bundle stuff up and you sell a box of stuff, or you sell a bunch of PDFs, and it's kind of this road to riches. And what's happened, I'd say it really started in earnest with the Kindle, but it's also strongly fed by Spotify and podcasting and YouTube, is that there's this huge downward pressure on prices. And this doesn't mean the information is worthless, but it definitely means that you have to be much, much, much smarter about how you niche it and who you sell to, and understand exactly why your customer is buying. And I've been watching very intently as the bottom has fallen out of the music industry. Of course, you're a music guy, so you could actually know much more about this than I do. But even just as an outsider, it's like, well, the marketplace has determined that the value of an album is approximately zero. Okay. And regardless of how much money it costs to produce or anything else. And like, one of my favorite musicians is Stephen Wilson from the UK. And he's a little bit older than me, and he's kind of an old school music guy from the standpoint of, like the guy likes a record that he can hold in his hand, and he likes to buy music that way. But even at one point he caved in, and he just started putting his music on the online distribution, the free services like Spotify, because it's like, well, they'll just find some other album to listen to. It doesn't matter if his albums are masterpieces. So I think the starting point is you have to know what you're up against. And, Tom, you talk on your website about all these marketing experts being full of BS. Well, it's true. And there's a lot of people, they'll make this sound really easy. And I don't think you should regard it that way. You should regard it as a challenge. So that's the starting point. Well, what that means then is that you need to speak to needs that are not being met by the free things that are in the market. So that could be as simple as, well, you're a trustworthy authority that will assemble all the information, and they will know that they're not getting erroneous information, and they'll simply buy confidence. So here's a story that illustrates this. When I bailed out of the Dilbert Cube and started my consulting firm, I had a consulting gig coming up, and my wife said, all right, we got to get you a suit. And she takes me to the mall. She's like, you got to look right for this thing. And so we go to the mall and we go to JCPenney and we spent about 4 minutes there. And when nobody came to wait on us, she's like, all right, we're going to do something else here. And she makes a beeline for Nordstrom. And I'm like, Nordstrom, you got to be kidding. And she goes, you have to look right. And she walks up to the guy and she explains what I need. And the guy very calmly and confidently, he walks over. He says, well, you probably need this kind of a blazer and you need these kind of slacks and you want this kind of a turtleneck. And he clearly knew what he was doing. And he explains, you know, we can have, and this was in the evening. He said, we could all have this tailored and custom fit for you and ready by 1 o'clock tomorrow. And she's like, all right, deal. And this is how I parted with $1,200 for an outfit that wasn't even as sophisticated as a full suit. Hmm. And you know, I figured we were going to go to JCPenney and spend $350. But the difference was if I went to JCPenney and I got a JCPenney guy helping me, I would hopefully look right. If I went to Nordstrom and talked to their guy, I would unquestionably look right. And the difference between possibly and unquestionably was easily worth all about $850. And so that's a factor. But of course, then you need to prove that you are unquestionably trustworthy and right with whatever forms of social proof. And in my opinion, you also need to be unquestionably right, because I think anybody that endeavors to teach anything takes on a grave responsibility for the welfare of other people, because you're saying, listen, if you pay attention to me instead of everybody else out there, you're going to be more successful than if you listen to them. And I think that should not be a lie. That should actually be the truth. You know, people are going to spend a lot more money following your advice than they are paying you for the advice. Right. So they're taking on a lot of risks. So you really do need to know what you're talking about. So I think those are the starting points of this conversation.
Yeah, I think so. And I've been talking about this quite a bit, especially since I've seen a lot of people successful on Udemy trying to move into their own courses. And I'm like, well, the first thing you got to think of is that you will have a different type of buyer, right? You will have a Walmart shopper on Udemy and you'll have a Nordstrom. And I actually use that same store as an example when they buy from you, because, you know, they have different needs and they're looking for different things. You know, one is buying in bulk, the other one wants the right thing that's going to get him to where he needs to go. So yeah, I've used that example a lot too. And you're right, people should know what they're teaching and have social proof. That's so key.
So there's a very useful chapter in 80/20 Sales and Marketing. I believe it's chapter 21, but it's how to do tens of thousands of dollars of market research in a single afternoon. And it's about using social media and forums and surveys to find out exactly what your audience really wants and is willing to pay for. And I'll just shortcut that by summarizing some of the real key points. If you ask somebody whether verbally or on a form or via email or any way that you can contact them. So let's say that we have an agreed upon topic, or they search something on Google and you could put an ad based on their search term. So if they're searching for Vietnamese potbelly pigs, then you can ask them a question like, you know, what's your most important problem or question about Vietnamese potbelly pigs right now? And that's question number one. Question number two is, how hard has it been for you to find this information? Like, not very hard, sort of hard, or very hard. So it's multiple choice. And then the third one is, so what difference would it make if you could solve this problem? And you're asking them about their motivations. Well, so you got one multiple choice and two fill in the blanks. And so if you survey 100 people and they answer the questions, what you do is you throw all that in a spreadsheet and you throw away all the answers where people said, it's not been very hard to find this. And you throw away all the answers that say, it's been sort of hard, and you only keep the very hards. Okay. And then you throw away the short answers and you keep the long ones. The people that wrote you a little tiny novel, even though you only gave them, a little space, you know, that's 3 inches wide, right? And they tell you all the stuff about their life. Those are the people that would actually spend money on stuff. And they are describing to you what it is that they are looking for. And they are describing to you what difference it would make for them. And you have to remember something. The number of unsolved problems in the world never goes down.
Yeah.
Okay. It never goes down. It always goes up. So it always looks like everything is solved. There's no more room for me. All the good ideas are all taken up. All the topics are already written about. Blah, blah, blah. The truth is that, you know, whatever people can readily get now, that's worthless. That's free on YouTube. But whatever they still can't solve is worth whatever it's worth. Okay. And so there's always a place to make money solving the next problem that nobody else has bothered to solve. So you take a bunch of surveys and they say, well, I've never been able to find anybody that knows how to do this or has a product that does this or has a course on this or whatever, then, well, you're going to have to go solve a problem. I mean, that's probably the hardest part, is you're going to have to figure out how to solve a problem that at least most people surfing the web or using whatever tools they have can't solve. And so maybe most of those problems, you can't solve them either, but you can solve some of them. And that's really the way you chisel your way in. And, I think that term is useful in a lot of different ways. You know, as the Google AdWords guy, for years and years, I've talked about chiseling your way into a market that's very crowded on Google. Well, there's 4 spaces at the top of Google, and there's 160 advertisers. So how are you going to get in there? Well, the way you get in there is what I just told you. Because if you're the only person who's actually truly addressing that problem, then either everybody else is saying they can too and they're lying, or you're going to have something very unique that you can say that nobody else can say. It's usually more of the latter. And so it's about rifle shots. Like, it's sharp shooting. It's not shotgun blast. And so most of the time in marketing, if something isn't working, you narrow your focus even narrower than before. And or you break the problem into pieces and make the pieces work. And so that's been my approach. And, you know, you'll find that markets are always evolving. And what was really brand new, state of the art, last year is old news this year. And so, you know, if you're in the business of selling online courses, in most niches, you are a cat on a hot tin roof. You need to stay on the cutting edge. You can't just be on the cutting edge once.
It's true. What you mentioned is pretty much positioning. You know, and I always say when things are not working, usually it's the positioning that's off. That's the first thing we should be looking at, not changing colors of buttons and aesthetics, right? But when you said narrow things in even more, Can you give any examples of that? Because I think that's super interesting.
Okay, so I used to know this guy. He wrote a course on speed writing. And it was called How to Write a Book in 14 Days or Less. And for quite a while, I was his affiliate. And because I liked the course, and so I started selling it. So I start doing my keyword research, and there were all of these different variations on how to write a book. You know, how to write a best-selling book, how to write a novel, how to write this, how to write that, all these little variations. And if you've ever done any keyword research, you kind of know the gig. You know, you've got the root keyword and it's got the most searches, and then you have this whole list of derivative keywords with declining search volumes on them all. Well, so there was one of the things that people would search on was how to write a children's book. Well, there was not, as far as I could tell, anywhere at the time, there was not any course on how to write a children's book. So you could carve off that little slice of the market. You could make a course called How to Write a Children's Book. You could do a survey like I just told you and find out all the things that are supposed to be in your book. And you could put it out there. And the day you open for business, you are the number one person in an underserved market. And what I just described to you is actually the way that you chisel your way into any market, regardless of we're talking Google or Facebook or direct mail or anything else. Richard Koch calls this the star principle. You want to be number one in a growing market. And one of the things about going into a market, and this is more true now than it has ever been in history, what I'm about to tell you, it does you almost no good to be number two. And if you're number three or four, you are in the poverty line. Okay. You need to be number one. Okay. So you want to be Coke. And if you can't be Coke, don't be Pepsi, be 7-Up. Okay. But don't be RC.
Right.
And don't be Sierra Mist. Okay. And if you can't be 7-Up, be Dr. Pepper, but don't be Mr. Pibb. And you sure don't want to be Shasta. Okay. It's better to be a big fish in a little pond, by far. Okay. And so when I say like narrow it, you know, you can do very basic keyword research on almost anything, and you can find sub niches within a topic that no one is addressing. They are all over the place. Now, some of them might be ridiculously tiny, not worth your time. That's often going to be true. But they're not all that way. There is always something just below the level of the big guy paying attention to it, where you can splinter that off, that you carve off a slice of the market that is unaddressed. Just like, you know, well, there's already a king of how to write a book, but I could be king of how to write a children's book, or I could write a book on how to illustrate a children's book, or, you know, whatever, right? And I can carve that off and I can own that. And then I can start extending my reach of what I do in that market and maybe even make it a bigger market than it used to be by somehow redefining it. So this positioning, like you said, Tom, this is the paramount issue. You cannot get around this. And if you're going into a market where the day you open for business, you're going to be number 10, and then you think you're just going to claw your way to the top, well, let me just save you a whole bunch of money and months or years of heartache. No, you need to go after something that you can be king. And there's all kinds of ways to be king. I mean, if you're the only Mexican restaurant in a small town, well, you can be the king of Mexican restaurants in that town. You don't have to be Taco Bell, and you don't have to be one of these big chains. You just need to be the only one there.
Yeah, that's true. It's usually not that easy online in the online space because, you know, unlike a city, you can find anything from anywhere. But I did find people having success with smaller niches that are just very lucrative. So, for example, I had a chiropractor that was teaching other chiropractors how to do some special method of curing people, you know. And each one of those courses was about $4,000 or $5,000 just because it was such a high value thing. And, you know, the chiropractors, they knew the value of it. So the market kind of maxed out at 80,000. You know, we did that research on LinkedIn, on Facebook, and, you know, just from his experience, that was about the market. But he was still able to make a good living just because it was very lucrative.
Well, so now you're also bringing up pricing. So I find in my own work, and this may not be true in other markets, but I find it's not terribly useful to play even near the bottom of the market. Now, in my opinion, the bottom of any market is books. Like if we're talking about viable people who will spend money on anything, you know, if somebody only watches free YouTube videos, they may never spend a single penny on advice or information or anything. You get to books, well, you know, I write very good books and they could justifiably be $2,000 courses, but I'm getting volume instead. But then the next step up, for the most part, is, you know, things north of $1,000. Now, I do have things that are less than that on my website, but we make the bulk of our money on more expensive offerings. And what it comes down to is, well, is this problem worth money to solve? Is this bleeding neck, like, will people pay money to make this bleeding stop? Well, if they really, really need to make the bleeding stop and there is no other way, then they will pay money for it. If they have it, well, and that's the other thing, they have to have the money. In fact, this is a great place to introduce the five power disqualifiers. I have a friend, John Paul Mendoza, who... he hitchhiked to Vegas when he was 17 and became a professional gambler. And he lived in the professional gambling world for about 3.5 years. And towards the end of his days in Vegas, he's sitting in a restaurant. And these two guys in his restaurant booth are having an argument. Yes, you will. No, I won't. Yes, you will. No, I won't. Yes, you will. And out comes a Glock. And the guy's like, yes, you will. And John looks at that and he goes, you know what? If you keep hanging out with these people, you're going to get a bullet. And it's not going to be fun. And he left. He just left professional gambling entirely. And he got a job working for this technology company. And now, so John at this point, he's like 20, 21 years old. But he's got 3 years of professional gambling street smarts. And so he's quite a bit more people savvy and street savvy than most sales guys. And his boss puts 206 leads on his desk. And he says, here, John, I want you to go see all of these people and I want you to go sell them something. John took a look at that and he's like, there ain't no way that anywhere near, he's using 80-20, there ain't no way anywhere near 206 of these people are worth going to see. So how do I decide who I want to go see? Because I'm not going to drive all over Southern California just to see all these people. And so he came up with this ingenious thing called the five power disqualifiers. And they are the five things that are always true anytime anybody buys anything from anybody. Okay, and so that's pretty good. And here's what they are. Number one, They have the money. If they don't have the money, they're not going to buy the stuff. And as simple as that sounds, I cannot tell you how many hundreds of hours, days, weeks, and years I spent chasing around customers who didn't have the money. And somehow, at some level, I must have thought that if I sang Kumbaya and whatever, that like they would start to have money. And it just wasn't true. They have the money. Number two, they have a bleeding neck. Okay, well, what do I mean by that? Well, you may have found, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but like you get in some accident and you're bleeding, or you got a broken arm or whatever, and you go to the hospital emergency room and you think you are having a first-class crisis, and the lady's like, here, you know, fill out a clipboard and go sit over there, right? And like 2 hours later, you're sitting there with your broken arm and some copies of Good Housekeeping magazine, and they still haven't seen you, right? But like some guy comes in with a gunshot wound and blood is squirting out of his aorta on the ceiling, they don't give him a clipboard, right? They march him right into some office and somebody starts seeing right away. Well, that's what I mean by bleeding neck. Like, is this really urgent? And urgency, like, oh, I got to solve this right now. That's a major, major component of selling anything. Number three, do they buy into your unique selling proposition? Like yours specifically. Do they buy into your way of solving this problem? If they don't, they're not going to buy. Number four, do they have the ability to say yes? So if you're selling a kitchen remodel and the husband is there and the wife is not, the husband can say no, but he cannot say yes. Only she can say yes, usually, right? Or, you know, some sale where, like a business-to-business sale where you go see some engineer and he can say no, but he can't approve the purchase. Well, then you're talking to the wrong guy. So that's the fourth one. And the fifth one is it fits their overall plans. So have the money, bleeding neck, agree with your USP, ability to say yes, fits their overall plans. Those are the five power disqualifiers. So John goes through this whole list of 206. He has 12 meetings and he closes six of them. Hmm. Well, what that tells you is that 80-20 says marketing is not a convincing people process. Marketing is a disqualification process. Before you start trying to convince people to buy, you need to figure out who's not going to buy and get rid of them or move them out of the way or not focus on them, not spend any more time on them, not spend any more money on them, and narrow it down just to the people who are a fit. And this is a complete reversal of the way most salespeople and marketers think, because most salespeople and marketers are like, well, I'm trying to get everybody and I'm trying to sell everybody and everybody would love this. And this is something that would help everybody. Well, the first thing is anytime somebody shows me a product and they say, absolutely anybody could buy this, absolutely everybody would like this, I'm like, uh-oh. Like, that's a bad sign.
Yeah, that's very bad.
Like, I would rather, it's like, well, dude, you're not Sony. You're not Starbucks. You're not General Motors. Like, start by selling to Vietnamese potbelly pig owners in Chiang Mai, Thailand. Like, start with that. Like, nobody's selling them, you know, nobody's selling them Vietnamese potbelly pig sweaters. But I am. So I'm the only game in town. Much easier to start small and start narrow than to like, oh, you know, we're going to make a killing in the $1 trillion education industry. Oh, brother, that guy's waiting to go splat.
That sounds like an opening line on Shark Tank.
Yeah, exactly. Right? You know, the stuff that works on Shark Tank is rarely something that, oh, you know, this could be in Walmart tomorrow morning. No, it's usually narrower than that.
Yeah, but most of them do say, if we only get that 1% of the billion-dollar, you know, industry, I'll make money. I'm like, no, you're not. You're not even going to give me this. Like, when people sometimes try to do e-commerce, right? And I know this is more about online courses, but just with e-commerce. And they're talking to me about competing with Amazon. I'm like, dude. Like, you are not in the same game as Amazon at all. Mm-mm. You don't even have tickets to the game yet. Like, what are you worrying about?
Right.
Like, what are you worrying about? It's like, you're in a whole different, like, just stop. Don't mention Amazon. Like, it's got nothing to do with your business. But yeah, you know, with courses, the one thing I wish that you expanded on a little bit was the bleeding neck. How do you disqualify that? Because not many people online have a bleeding neck problem. You know, it's very rarely that they do. There's some. There's definitely some. But I've seen courses being quite successful that don't always have that bleeding neck. I guess the pain point maybe hurts more than the money they have to spend, you know, and that's what we always try to, you know, position when we sell. But how do you disqualify the bleeding neck in this scenario?
Well, look, we've all bought things that we did not urgently need, but just on a relative basis, you should always ask yourself the question, okay, is this something that would just be nice to have at the end of the day, or is this something they really, really need? Are we preventing a problem, or are we curing a problem? Okay, so there's the very popular saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And it's true. It's completely true. However, people will pay 16 times more for an ounce of cure than they will for a pound of prevention.
Right.
Okay, if a guy, so think of people with heart disease, okay? There are people who are, you know, in theory, they have been told by their doctor, they could look in the mirror and tell, their wife has told them, oh, dude, like, you better start exercising, you better stop eating all that pizza, you're going to keel over. And they don't listen. But the minute that guy starts having a heart attack, he might write a check for $250,000 to make that thing go away. He might write a check of any size if you can cure his heart attack right now. And so a really good way to frame this is, okay, yeah, I know we all want to sell prevention and we want to be wise and we want to be sensible and all that kind of stuff. But a really good question to ask is, what part of the problem can I cure right now? And maybe it's only a fraction, okay? Maybe it's like, well, I have something that will cure 10% of his heart attack, or will cure his heart attack 10% of the time. Well, okay, then that's worth a certain amount of money. It's worth more than zero. And a lot of times I look at problems and I say, well, can I break this problem into 7 or 8 different parts and solve just a part of this problem? Like, well, I can't solve all your problems, but I can make this one part of your problem go away. And you eat the elephant one bite at a time. And most of the time, like you said, hey, you know, I got lots of people selling all kinds of online courses and they're not necessarily bleeding necks. The number one reason why the customer bought at that time was more likely a bleeding neck issue. Hmm. Well, there's some immediate gratification or some immediate pain relief that I'm going to get out of this, even if it's just on page 5. And I'll go back and get the rest later. But I want this little part right now.
That's interesting, but it's true. When I think of myself buying online courses, there was this one long, long time ago when I first started outsourcing. And I got a course on outsourcing only because the guy mentioned that he's going to talk about the tax implications, which was the only thing I was thinking about. I didn't have an answer for. So I bought the whole course just to get, I don't know, maybe a sentence. Just are there or aren't there?
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
And taxes is always a bleeding neck. always, right? I mean, like, well, either I'm bleeding today or bleeding tomorrow or bleeding on April 15 or something, but right. It's bleeding, right?
That's true. How did you come up with pricing for some of your courses? Because I know you do in-person workshops too, so you probably kind of, you know, judged what you sell that for a little bit before you made the courses. But I'm just curious how you tested the pricing and came up with it for yours.
Well, we've done a bunch of different things. Let me just start out with 80-20 tells you that if you sell, so I call this the Starbucks principle of the $2,700 espresso machine. So 80-20 says 20% of the people want to spend 80% of the money. And 20% of the 20% want to spend 80% of the 80%. And 20 of the 20 want to spend 80 of the 80 of the 80. So like that means the way Mother Nature works, the way the laws of physics work, 50% of your money ought to be coming from 1% of your customers. And that's a fact. Mm-hmm. And we design our business to take advantage of that. And so what that means is for every 1,000 people who buy a $5 latte at Starbucks, one person will buy a $2,700 gleaming stainless steel espresso machine. Okay, so for every $5,000 of lattes, you will sell $2,700 of machine. Okay, it's very likely that the business success or failure depends on them having an espresso machine. The lattes keep the lights on, and the profit is in the high-end stuff. And most businesses actually work that way. And so one of the most important concepts in selling online courses is that the affordable ones keep the lights on and the expensive upsells are what actually makes the business its money. And you can think of the low-end stuff as being loss leaders. And so you can have your basic version, and then you can have a deluxe version that's four times as expensive, and 20% of the people will buy it if it meets the needs, if it's clearly more valuable than the basic version, and if it's what people are looking for, you'll sell 20%. And do the math, well, you'll make 1.8 times more money just by having that one additional upsell than you would if you only had the one. And so we build upsells into lots of things that we do because we're looking for the needles in haystacks who will buy those more expensive offerings.
Yeah, when I was in sales working for some of the bigger corporations, we always called it chasing whales. Those were the expensive products. And one of the things we were taught was that if you keep chasing the whales, you're going to go broke. So the managers would always say, where's your bread and butter, which is the low, the lower product, right? So it's always the same thing, but you got to have your bread and butter, which will put the food on the table. And then once in a while, you're going to catch a whale, which is going to make a ton of profit for you. So it seems like the same strategy with the online courses.
Yeah. And so the reality of most online courses is that they are really just, they are paths towards a service that you provide or a high-end product or consulting or workshops or seminars or masterminds or cruises on cruise ships or experiences or, some higher end thing that a small number of people buy. And that's just how the world actually works. Just like, there is, to the best of my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's more money in the music industry now than there's ever been, but it's spent on merch and live concerts and, U2 goes on tour and they sell $30 million of tickets and stuff like that. It's like the bottom's fallen out. It's not in getting, you know, 0.005 cents a song on Spotify, right? And it's not from selling CDs and LPs. It's from licensing and maybe advertising sponsorships and things like that. But there's still a ton of money in the music industry. And so really, I just look at selling courses online as being, let's say, you know, 5 years behind the music industry in that regard.
Yeah, it's the music industry is just very different now. Very different. So, you know, before the label would advance you money, they would keep all the rights to mm-hmm. all the publishing rights, everything. They would give you a little bit, then you'd get maybe a little percentage at the end once all the expenses were paid. These days, mm-hmm. it's so interesting. You know, I was actually following one of these new hip hop guys from I think from the Bronx very recently, and he sold 500,000 albums on his release. This is after 6 months of starting his whole career online. You know, he built his own platform and everything. But what was so interesting about it is when they mentioned the 500,000, then they said the old type of sales, like, you know, selling albums, like he actually sold just 4,000. So they're counting things very differently too. But what he said is that when he came to Atlantic, because that's who he created the partnership with, like it was a whole different thing. Like he was getting billions of streams. He was selling albums already through iTunes and through everything. So he was able to just secure a distribution deal. Atlantic is still putting a lot of money behind it, but it's 50-50. He owns all the rights. He makes pretty much half of everything from every album. So he is able to make, you know, almost 100x of what a big star was making back in the days, you know. And then, like you said, the concerts, he's got a 50-50. So every concert, he makes 50%, you know, and that's insane. Merchandising, he owns his merchandising. So he makes almost 100%, just a little bit of expense. It's crazy, you know, and like you said, the concerts, that's where all the money is now. You know, we had these huge deals. I think it was like Livestream or Live Nation was putting like $20, $40, $80, $100 million to like giving these artists like Eminem, Madonna back in the days, like a few years ago, to go on concert tours. It's incredible. You know, like Jay-Z, he sold 1 million copies of his album before he released the album. He just made a deal with Samsung. You know, they bought 1 million copies of his album in exchange for, you know, marketing and being able to use it. But that's insane. Like, can you imagine being an artist and I'm going platinum before I put this thing out?
Well, so what you're referring to is owning a platform. So when you have an audience or a presence where you control the chessboard, then yes, you can get ridiculously sweet deals and percentages that 15 years ago would have been unthinkable. Yeah. It's like you said, the music business has completely changed. And so you know, all forms of publishing are changing in similar ways.
Yeah, I find with online courses, a lot of things have changed. You know, people don't buy information anymore. They buy transformation. The control is a huge piece. You know, being on Udemy, you know, I know clients are making $250,000 a year, but a small thing happens with Udemy, like they'll take 1,000 reviews off, or in 6 months, some courses will just stop selling because the algorithm wants new things. Zero control. You know, so what could be one of the best businesses in the world, where you have sort of passive income and control, and you know, if you get your marketing in place, like it's very stable, like it's super unstable just by being in a, you know, on someone else's platform. So I do find a lot of similarities, and things are changing. You know, people do want more of that white glove experience with the more expensive courses now. I don't know if you're seeing that.
Well, you know, what we find easiest to sell is things that are bundled together. So like we have memberships where if you're a member of Renaissance Club and you prepay a year, then you get very significant discounts on other courses and you get significant discounts on coming to seminars. When we sell high-end masterminds, we give, you know, we give people a whole variety of experiences and information and transformative things, not just one. And it becomes impossible to compute an a la carte price of each individual thing. And it makes it harder and harder to directly compare it to other things. I'll bring up another issue. My brother-in-law runs a site for jazz mandolin, and his wife, my sister, is sort of cynical about it, and she's like, oh yeah, well, you know, you've got all these minions that, you know, just want to, they can't spend enough money on mandolin, so I guess they're just going to give you some of their money. And I said, hey, you know, you need to take yourself more seriously than she does. I said, so I kind of know about what he does. And, you know, he starts him out like, well, the first thing is you have to get your fingering, you have to work these certain muscles so that your fingers will do exactly what you want to do when you're playing a mandolin. And then we're going to do this. And then we're going to do this. And so he starts with the foundations and he works his way up. And I said, listen, I said, by the time somebody's been with you a year or two and you have reinvented the way they play the instrument and you've gotten to think these other ways and you have this language that is particular to you, and what you end up with is these people have a hyper effective relationship with you, even if they've never met you before, because they know your mannerisms, they know your lingo, they know your approach, they've played their instrument for hours and hours your way. I said, at that point, they can learn more easily and more effectively from you than they can from any other instructor on the planet. And that's worth money. That's very efficient. So you can't devalue yourself. And you can't sit there and go, oh, well, I'm not sure if this is really all that valuable, or I'm not really sure if this is worth the money. To a percentage of people, it's worth a great deal. And that's a very important part. And I would say usually there's a significant personality element to something like this. And you acquire a tribe and you get people who think sort of like you and like the way that you see the world and they like the way that you solve problems. And, you know, at some point you can, to a degree, take them where you want them to go. And I think that's part of being an artist and creating a body of work is I think for a lot of people listening, what you really want to get to is where you have a solid fan base. Where because you turn things out on a regular basis, you have regular income, and that gives you a long enough leash to pursue your topic in other new directions that have been unexplored, and that audience, some of them at least, are willing to follow you and support your exploration. And it's the 21st century version of having patrons. Mm. So the classical composers like Bach and Mozart, you know, they had wealthy kings and merchants who would pay them to compose music. Well, you need an audience on the internet that lets you compose whatever it is that you compose. And when you get to that point, it's a very liberating thing, and it's a very special relationship that you can have with an audience, because you get them and they get you. And it might be the only place that either of you have people that get you. And so it's a wonderful time to be alive.
Yeah, the danger with that, and, you know, being in Chiang Mai, we have a lot of people here working on their laptops from all over the world, you know, thousands. Mm. And a lot of them are
I'm sure.
A lot of them are making very little money, right? And I don't hang out with them as much as I maybe should, but I've asked a few, like, so what are you doing? And they're like, well, right now, I'm not selling anything, you know, I'm just building influence. And I always think that's the dumbest thing you could ever be doing. Like, what do you mean you're building influence if you're not selling anything? It doesn't make any sense. But I think, you know, that's the danger zone, you know, with this whole influencing and building a platform. And people just don't understand that, you know, the way it should be done, you know, build it while you're selling, you know, but, you know, they're going about it the wrong way. Like, they just want the fan base without actually producing anything or giving, you know, the value that's going to make money for them.
Well, if you are in any kind of an advice giving business, so like, I realize that, you know, there may be a difference between, like, you know, let's say a health coach, right, versus, I don't know, maybe you're just teaching people how to play chess or something. But, like, so let's say you're a health coach and you want to make $175 an hour. Well, what you do is you charge $175 an hour and you make a big promise. But if you sit on Facebook or email or Twitter or whatever, and you just talk to people for free all day long, hoping that eventually you're going to earn enough trust that they will, oh, you know, yeah, I think I should hire her. That will almost never happen. Like, you have to put your price out there and make a big promise first, and then do all that other stuff second. Oh my goodness. You can just waste years of your life. Oh, years. And people do. I remember, yeah, probably about 10 years ago, I remember a number of people saying to me, you taught me to just stop working for free. And now I'm making money because I'm not sitting here behind my computer answering emails from skeptical people, hoping that they'll eventually think that I'm worth something, right. That's like the most demoralizing, degrading thing that you can do. Especially since you don't even know how many of those people in actual real life are just trolls. So
what's funny that you mentioned that, you know, when I do Facebook campaigns for anyone in any niche, I always exclude anyone from the Skeptic Society.
Those people are the worst.
Yeah, but just as a rule of thumb.
Well, yeah, Skeptic, look, I'm an electrical engineer and I understand the scientific method and I understand skepticism and I understand proof. And all of that, I totally get it. Believe me, okay. And anybody that's read my courses or anything, they would get that. But when skepticism goes from being a tool in your toolbox to some kind of an identity, you have a seriously dysfunctional person with probably has major trust issues and maybe major father issues or who knows what. And I have a lot of experience of this because of my Evolution 2.0 project, which is a whole nother conversation that I doubt we have time for. Yeah, but you're right. And I got to give you credit because I've never actually heard somebody recommend to actually exclude people in the skeptic, communities from Facebook groups. But that's absolutely right. That's good. I tip my hat to you on that one.
Thank you. From your experience, when you were marketing your online courses, what channel or channels have you found work the best for you? Because, you know, Facebook is the hot thing today. You know, now LinkedIn's becoming the hot thing. But what are you finding from your experience?
Well, let me give you a generic answer first.
Yep.
In 80/20 sales and marketing, we give you access to the marketing DNA test. And Tom, are you familiar with the Kolbe test? Have you ever used that tool before?
It sounds familiar. I'd have to look it up.
Really, for people who know the Kolbe test, the Kolbe predicts how people relate to their work in some very useful ways. And I looked at the Kolbe test and I said, we need one of those for marketing. We need a way of figuring out how people persuade. Because after consulting in 300 industries and working with every kind of marketing and salesperson you can imagine, I've seen that there are wildly different sales approaches and personalities and personality types. And they can all be effective if you put them in the right zone. Okay, so there's a kind of salesperson that I call a hostage negotiator. Okay, and that's a guy who can think on his feet and work really fast and has very high empathy. And you just throw him in a situation and he doesn't even remember what he says when he leaves, but he got the deal or he got the hostages released or whatever, right? And, you know, that guy, if he sends you an email, the subject line probably says no subject because he can't, like, slow himself down enough to compose a proper email, okay? And you probably know people like that. There's another kind of guy who or gal who will sit in a cave for 4 months and they will write, you know, 186 pages of email and copy and autoresponders and video sales letter scripts, and they'll string it all together. And finally, on the appointed day, they'll press send. And the thing will go out there. It'll be this big, giant product launch or something, and they'll make like $800,000, okay?
Right.
And that person, if you threw them in a hostage negotiator thing, they're so introverted and they think so slowly that they would get slaughtered. Okay. And then there's people that get up on stage and they pluck people's heartstrings. And there's other people that'll show you spreadsheets and proof and numbers and columns and graphs. And do you see what I'm saying? There's these different types. And we wrote the marketing DNA test so people could figure out what their type is. Like, if you should be a copywriter, this test will tell you to be a copywriter. If you should be making videos, it'll tell you that. Well, I find that what works best for anybody is being in a medium that matches their marketing DNA. Okay, so my greatest strength personally is I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I speak and I do podcasts and conversations like this, but my best foot forward is my writing. So my media, personally, are books and email. And books and email hold my whole world together. Now, for somebody else, I've had in the last 20 years, I've had close to 1 million people get on my email lists. Now, only a fraction of those are still alive, but I mean, I'm just saying, like, I've gotten like 1 million people that come through my world. I've only got I don't know how many, most of my YouTube videos on my YouTube channel have a couple thousand views or even less. Right? Well, okay, I'm not a video guy. So what medium you should be in really depends on your strengths. Now you asked specifically, well, what's working? Well, Facebook retargeting works really well. Google search works well in markets where it's not bloody, brutally, fist pounding competitive. Mm-hmm. And if really dial it in and you get trained properly and you know what you're doing. Another comment is, it is always the case that in any of the sophisticated platforms, there are ways of targeting and ways of using the platform that most of the advertisers don't know about and don't understand. And if you go deep into the medium, for example, Facebook and Google have in-market audiences, which were their people. For example, Google has figured out this guy's looking for a refrigerator. or this guy's looking to buy a car. And they can identify those people. Well, most advertisers don't know how to use that feature. And so if you get really good at certain parts of a platform, now another form of advertising that's been underrated for quite a few years is YouTube advertising. If you do it right, and if you target it properly, and if you're what you do and who you are is suitable for video, then you could go really far with YouTube advertising. So hopefully that's helpful. I mean, there's a lot of ways to skin that cat.
No,
but, you need to sell the way you sell. And you've already been selling that way, like when things have worked for you. Like it's just a continuation of the pattern. You have a history that would suggest what you should be doing. And you need to be very careful not to get pigeonholed into some marketing guru's agenda or, you know, like, well, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Right. That's true. What do you do about your courses being bootlegged and just keeping people inside and finishing them? What sort of tactics do you use?
Well, we hire a service, and I forget the name of them, but we pay them like over $1,000 a month, and they go conk all those guys on the head. I mean, that's the only way I've found to deal with piracy is you get somebody that's got the capacity to send the cease and desist letters and shut them down. And so we've had very few, we've probably been doing that for 5 years, and we've had very few problems that get squashed right away, but it's a cost of doing business.
Yeah.
It just seems to be a necessity. And, another thing that I do is we build autoresponder sequences that spoon feed the content of a course to the person. My goal is, even if they never open the shrink wrap or never watch the videos, and they just read the emails we send them, that they would get, you know, the 1% of the information, this 50% of the utility, you know, just that way. And we do encourage consumption. And, you know, I talk about the other courses and the other seminars and everything that we've done, and people keep hearing about them and hearing about them. Eventually they're like, yeah, well, I think I'm going to get that. So yeah, when I talk to Tiffany and I renew my subscription, then I'm going to get a bonus or something for a special discount. And yeah, I'm going to add that course because I've been wanting to have it for quite a while. And so, yeah, I mean, we really have a community. It's not just a bunch of people. It's not like Udemy. It's not just a bunch of people that are just buying stuff.
Makes sense. Perry, thank you for coming on. This went a little longer than we usually do, but I really appreciate it. Where can people find you?
If you go to sell8020.com, sell8020.com, it'll take you to 8020 Sales and Marketing for a penny plus shipping. So that's 14 international, 7 U.S., plus you get some videos that aren't included if you buy it on Amazon. And you can really watch how our sales funnel works. That book will change your life. It will change the way you see everything in marketing. It will simplify what you do in marketing. It will show you a bunch of things that, oh my goodness, I don't need to do this anymore. I don't need to do that anymore. I don't need to talk to these people anymore. And it'll turn marketing from a convincing people process into a disqualification process, which gives you much more authority. So sell8020.com.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that book. Recommend it. Thank you again, Perry.
Great talking.
Before you go, let me know if you enjoyed this interview. Leave a review, subscribe, join the Smart Brand Marketing Facebook page, whatever is easiest. Also, if you need my help marketing your online course, or know that your business could use some SEO, come to smartbrandmarketing.com, check out the case studies, and reach out to me. Once again, smartbrandmarketing.com. Until next time.